From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. After igniting a political firestorm with his criticism of George Bush on 60 Minutes this weekend, former White House counterterrorism coordinator Richard Clark testified today before the 9/11 Commission in Washington. Clark opened his remarks with a solemn apology addressed to families of 9/11 victims in the hearing room.
Your government failed you. Those entrusted with protecting you failed you. And I failed you. We tried hard, but that doesn't matter because we failed. And for that failure, I would ask, once all the facts are out, for your understanding and for your forgiveness.
Following appearances by CIA Director George Tenet and Clinton's National Security Advisor Sandy Berger, Clark's testimony was the most anticipated and controversial in 2 days of public hearings by the bipartisan 10-member National Commission on Terrorist Attacks upon the United States. Hearings designed to shed light on how a group of zealots armed only with box cutters managed to strike the Pentagon, bring down the Twin Towers, and kill thousands of innocent people. Tonight on Point, we listen and critique the testimony from day two in the commission's public search for answers. We begin in Washington, where Gail Shattuck, congressional reporter for the Christian Science Monitor, covered today's hearing. Good evening and welcome, Gail.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. Gail, was Richard Clark's testimony today as sharp and contentious as expected or feared, depending where you're coming from?
Absolutely. I think this was historic testimony. You could tell it even in day one of the hearings, because usually the way these hearings are conducted, the commission staff presents a report, and then all of the questioning is around the report. But this time, there were members of the commission that actually brought the Clark book to the table. And if you listen closely, most of the questions were driven by that book.
Gail, there have been a lot of heavy hitters testifying in these 2 days. The director of the CIA, two secretaries of state, national security advisors, secretary of defense, two of them. As you listen to this testimony, does Richard Clark's witness bear greater weight somehow than that of others? Or is it just that he's more pointed, that he's more critical? Is this intrinsically somehow more important or just more fiery?
Well, it's more fiery, but you also have to remember that Richard Clark has been deeply respected going back four administrations on this issue. So you had Madeleine Albright, Colin Powell, both former Secretary of State, former Secretary. You had a pairing of William Cohen, Don Rumsfeld, former Secretary of Defense, current Secretary. You had George Tenet, Director of Central Intelligence, who was in both. You had Sandy Berger, former Assistant for National Security Affairs. But the missing person was, in a sense, as eloquent as Clark, and that, of course, was Condoleezza Rice. And I think the White House decision not to allow her to testify, and that is how the commissioners represented it, that she perhaps wanted to come, but the White House felt that this was a principled matter. Her absence spoke volumes, I would argue, as loud as Clark's presence.
I would say Condoleezza Rice has been absent, but by no means silent in recent days, and even this evening, just within the last couple of hours, calling Richard Clark's testimony scurrilous. What was the main thrust of his testimony today?
He made 2 points. He said, as you began with the entry to this program, mm-hmm. your government failed you. And he also made the point that for the Bush administration, terrorism was not an important priority. And he's pointedly distinguished it with President Clinton's administration. He said for Clinton, it was there was no higher priority. His book, I think, as much as his testimony, suggests that the White House was much more focused on classic Cold War issues, missile defense, Russia, China, that they didn't have the expertise at the top to think through issues involving terrorism and didn't think that they were urgent or important.
And what kind of reception did he get from the commission today?
Very partisan. This is an interesting point because this commission has been decidedly nonpartisan.
Bipartisan, 5 Republicans, 5 Democrats.
But today you didn't need badges to tell you on what side these commissioners stood. Some of the Republican commissioners very pointedly said to Mr. Clark, your credibility is at stake here. You know, are you just trying to sell books? Are you part of a presidential campaign? At one point, he actually had to say under oath that he would not take a job with the Kerry administration.
So that was getting right to the heart of it. And we also heard today from George Tenet, from Sandy Berger, from Richard Armitage, Deputy Secretary of State. Any new ground broken there or familiar messages?
I think the new ground is how intractable this problem of, you know, they call it stove-piped intelligence, how difficult it is for information that could be used or actionable to get to the top. I think part of the most memorable parts involved looking at images where Osama bin Laden was actually in sight, could have been taken out, and the reasons he wasn't. I think, to my mind, after the Clark flap dies down, this is something that people are going to have to take very seriously. Have we moved from a whole culture of national intelligence defined for people of my generation by the Church Committee hearings, which in effect said, you know, there are limits to what the United States will do overseas. We don't assassinate foreign leaders. We don't spy on our own citizens and so forth. In a way, the hearings these last 2 days were the unchurch hearings. Because all
saying,
the
why didn't you do that?
Why didn't you do that? Why didn't you take him out when you could have? Why didn't you fire? Mm-hmm. And what you were hearing from the responses, both on the intelligence side, from the diplomats, and from the secretaries of defense, was Congress wouldn't have backed it. Before 9/11, no one would have supported an invasion of Afghanistan or even, you know, pointedly taking out this leader. Mm-hmm. So I think what we're seeing is much more important than whether, you know, Clark's book brings down, you know, the strongest case in the Bush presidential campaign.
And maybe this bipartisan commission of largely of former members of Congress signaling a change in national policy that de facto becomes the new attitude perceived in Congress.
I think that's exactly what's happening, and that's why it's historic. But you have to go a little bit deeper than the presidential campaign to see it. But I think these are hearings that people are going to be studying for a very long time. The last today and yesterday, I haven't seen anything like this since Watergate.
Gail, thanks very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Gail Shattuck is congressional reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. She spoke with me from Washington. We are talking tonight about day two of the 9/11 hearings on Capitol Hill. Testimony today by George Tenet, Sandy Berger, Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage, and the incendiary Richard Clark. Are these hearings working? Are they nailing down accountability or not? If your loved one had died on 9/11, would you feel that you were getting the whole story now? And after all the waiting, what's the takeaway from these 2 days of public testimony? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Ruhul Gharek, former Middle East specialist for the CIA and director of the Middle East Initiative at the Project for the New American Century. Good evening and welcome, Ruhul Gharek.
Good evening.
Thanks for being with us. Also with us tonight from Washington is Lawrence Korb, former Assistant Secretary of Defense under Ronald Reagan and a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and a senior advisor to the Center for Defense Information. Good evening and welcome, Lawrence Korb.
Nice to be with you, Tom.
Good to have you. Also with us in the studio tonight is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Jack, good to have you here.
Hello, Tom. Hello to our guests.
I think that for all of us, it might be good just to jump straight in with some of the testimony from today. Let's listen to the heart, perhaps, of Richard Clark's testimony, where he compares Clinton and Bush administrations' postures toward the threat of terrorism.
I want to know, first of all, was fighting al-Qaeda a top priority for the Clinton administration from 1998 to the year 2001? How high of priority was it in that Clinton administration during that time period?
My impression was that fighting terrorism in general and fighting al-Qaeda in particular were an extraordinarily high priority in the Clinton administration, certainly no higher priority. They were priorities probably of equal importance, such as the Middle East peace process. But I certainly don't know of one that was any higher in the priority of that administration.
With respect to the Bush administration, from the time they took office until September 11th, 2001, You had much to deal with, Russia, China, G8, the Middle East. How high a priority was fighting al-Qaeda in the Bush administration?
I believe the Bush administration in the first 8 months considered terrorism an important issue, but not an urgent issue. President Bush himself says as much in his interview with Bob Woodward in the book Bush at War. He said, "I didn't feel a sense of urgency." George Tenet and I tried very hard to create a sense of urgency by seeing to it that intelligence reports on the al-Qaeda threat were frequently given to the president and other high-level officials. And there was a process underway to address al-Qaeda. But although I continued to say it was an urgent problem, I don't think it was ever treated that way.
Richard Clark, questioned there today, in this instance by a former Indiana congressman, Democrat Tim Romer. Jack Beatty, Lawrence Korb, Rule Direct, I want to get response from each of you to this characterization of the relative urgency applied to terrorism by these two administrations. Rule Direct, first to you. What do you make of Richard Clark's testimony here that he was in both administrations, in the middle, presumably, of their counterterrorism work? He says there was a difference, that the urgency declined, in effect, he's saying here, in the Bush administration. A fair criticism?
No, I find it a very odd criticism. I mean, I think what is striking about the Clinton administration, the Bush administration, the Clinton administration obviously lasting 8 years and the Bush lasting 7.5 months before 9/11, was the continuity, not the differences. I mean, if we take Mr. Clark at his word that there was no priority more important for the Clinton administration than al-Qaeda, then I think that's pretty damning testimony on the Clinton administration, because contrary to what we said, I don't think that actually the Clinton administration did put into practice, really did act urgently on that issue, neither with intelligence and operations in the field, not with diplomacy, and certainly not with planning military actions against al-Qaeda.
So why would Richard Clark give this kind of rather sharp analysis distinguishing the level of urgency in the two administrations?
Well, one can only speculate on that. I mean, I think he actually sort of revealed his hand in the testimony where he quite forthrightly said that he was greatly upset, if not angered, I think he even used stronger language than that, by the Bush's administration's decision to go to war in Iraq, something which Mr. Clark vehemently opposes. And I think that has, in fact, colored his reflection, and it has led him to retrospectively damn the 7.5 months of the Bush administration while excusing the 8 years of the Clinton administration.
Lawrence Korb, your interpretation here on how Richard Clark lays out the levels of urgency in two administrations leading up to 9/11.
Well, I think the startling thing about what Dick said was that everybody assumed that Bush was treating it more seriously than Clinton was. After all, the Bush administration had come into office claiming, basically, put it bluntly, that the Clinton administration were wimps. And so that's what was startling, that, in fact, they did not give it a high priority. And I agree with Raul that in the sense that Clinton did give it a high priority, but he didn't do as much as he should have. He did have the one attack in 1998, which, interestingly enough, was criticized roundly by many Republicans as a diversion from his troubles that he was having.
The wag the dog charge.
A wag the dog charge. So I think what Dick was trying to say is that that this administration wasn't really gung ho about it. And actually, even if you look at the plan that was adopted right before September 11th, it doesn't sound much different than the Clinton plan. You know, we'll negotiate, we'll pressure, and then finally, if that doesn't work, then we're going to, take strong action.
Lawrence Korb, Rule Direct, Jack Beatty, we'll be right back to you. Jack, I want to hear what you've got to say on this. We're looking at day two of the 9/11 hearings on Capitol Hill and what they tell us about the road to 9/11. Listeners, you can join the conversation. Are these hearings working? Are they getting to the bottom of 9/11? Are they nailing down accountability or not? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are looking at day two of the 9/11 hearings on Capitol Hill today and what they tell us about the road to 9/11. We're joined tonight from Washington by Lawrence Korb, former Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration, now a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, also from Washington by Ruhul Gorecht, director of the Middle East Initiative at the Project for a New American Century. He's a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Our own Jack Beatty is here as well. You can join this conversation. What did you hear in the testimony of George Tenet, of Richard Clark today? Is it realistic to try to pin blame on a person or an agency or a policy for 9/11? Is it a cop-out to say that it couldn't be helped? It's no one's fault. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jack, we'll hear a lot more tape tonight, but your thoughts as you listen to Richard Clark and the rest of the gang today before this commission?
Well, this question about what Clinton did and did not do, he was asked about this by Joe Connison over the weekend, and he was asked...
Bill Clinton was asked, or Clark was?
Clark was asked in an interview, and Clark quoted, and Connison quoted to him what the vice president said on Rush Limbaugh this week, that
Dick Cheney firing back.
Right, that the Clinton administration had, quote, no great success in dealing with terrorists. And he said, how about that? And this is what Clark said. He said there were many successes. The Clinton administration stopped Iraqi terrorism against the United States through military intervention. It stopped Iranian terrorism against the United States through covert action. It stopped the al-Qaeda attempt to have a dominant influence in Bosnia. It stopped the terrorist attacks at the Millennium. It stopped many other terrorist attacks, including on the U.S. Embassy in Albania. And it began a lethal covert action program against al-Qaeda. It also launched military strikes against al-Qaeda. Maybe the vice president was so busy running Halliburton at the time, said Clark, he didn't notice.
Ruhul Gorecht, there's in a sense the rebuttal from direct from Richard Clark to your observation that if this was the Clinton administration's top priority, it wasn't very effectively pursued.
Well, I think actually some of Mr. Clark's testimony at times is at odds with that list. I mean, I won't take the time to go through them all, but I would just say that first and foremost on the issue of al-Qaeda, there is now this view going around and stories, I think, that started with Bob Woodward's book, and you're beginning to see it also in Steve Cole's book, which is a much better book, on the rise of al-Qaeda, that the Central Intelligence Agency in particular was waging an undeclared war against al-Qaeda throughout the 1990s. I think that is historically just false. And Mr. Clark in particular was guilty of saying some comments in the late 90s and up until 2001 that suggested that the agency and American intelligence was scoring huge successes and that, in fact, bin Laden, before he went to bed every night around an Afghan campfire, was living in fear of the United States. I mean, I think that was just ridiculous at the time. And I would also just add on one other one on the issue of Iran. I don't think the United States stalemated Iranian terrorism. If that had been the case, I think we would have been much more successful against them before the Khobar Tower explosions. So I think the Clinton administration's record and dealing forcefully with terrorism is very, very mixed. I would also say the Millennium celebrations, I mean, Ahmad Rassam more or less shot himself in the foot.
This was the bomb coming in from Canada headed for L.A. airport.
Could not even cross the Canadian border. Let's just say the Canadian border is not one of the more difficult borders to cross. We were enormously lucky. If we look back at the attack, the attempted attack on the USS Sullivan's, which was a forerunner to the attack on a successful attack against the USS Cole in October of 2000. The only reason that attack did not succeed is that al-Qaeda, which isn't always a very good operationally organization, overloaded their skiff with explosives and sank it in the Aden Harbor. 9 months later, they'd become more professional and they used C-4 and they were able to blow an 80-foot hole in the and another destroyer. So I'm a bit dubious on that. I think that actually the Clinton administration, despite, I think, Mr. Clark's best efforts, and I think there were others in the administration who honestly began to feel the heat of al-Qaeda, was not able to actually get the leadership, in particular President Clinton, to treat the subject with the level of seriousness that it deserved.
Let's listen to some testimony right along those lines, and Lawrence Korb, I'll ask you for a response after we do. This is, again, former Congressman Tim Romer of Indiana asking Richard Clark about the response he got when he asked for an urgent meeting with Bush cabinet officials to discuss terrorism.
Do you get a response to this urgent request for a principal's meeting on these, and how does this affect your time frame for dealing with these important issues?
I did get a response. The response was that in the Bush administration, I should, and my committee, the Counterterrorism Security Group, should report to the deputies committee, which is a sub-cabinet level committee, and not to the principals. And that, therefore, it was inappropriate for me to be asking for a principal's meeting. Instead, there would be a deputy's meeting.
So does this slow the process down to go to the deputies rather than to the principals or a small group, as you previously had done?
It slowed it down enormously by months. First of all, the deputies committee didn't meet urgently in January or February. Then when the deputies committee did meet, it took the issue of Al-Qaeda as part of a cluster of policy issues, including nuclear proliferation in South Asia, democratization in Pakistan, how to treat the problems, the various problems, including narcotics and other problems in Afghanistan, and launched on a series of deputies' meetings extending over several months to address Al-Qaeda in the context of all of those interrelated issues. That process probably ended, I think, in July of 2001. So we were ready for a principals meeting in July, but the principals' calendar was full, and then they went on vacation, many of them, in August, so we couldn't meet in August. And therefore, the principals met in September.
Richard Clark, they're questioned by Tim Romer. And you can hear, Lawrence Korb, the frustration that he's communicating here, looking back on that spring and summer when, by many accounts, the tension and the fear was rising. He felt he could not get the hearing. He could not get the attention that he wanted, needed, for this issue. You've been inside government. Is this a reasonable complaint on the part of Richard Clark? Is this a sign of a failing in the Bush administration?
Well, I think it's a reasonable complaint because, as you just pointed out, there were indications that the threat level had gone up. George Tenet was talking about it. In fact, somebody used the term, you know, his hair was on fire, mm-hmm. complaining about what was going on. And at the end of January of 2001, the FBI and CIA did conclude, they had not up until then said that Al-Qaeda had blown up the coal. Clark had suspected, but without basically them concluding that, there was no, you know, definitive government position on there. Now, this is what's normal if you're trying to sort of revise the, you know, the policy toward trade or something. This is the way it goes. But when you have an urgent type of situation, or at least that it should have been perceived as urgent, no, this takes way, way too long. And the fact of the matter is that people going on vacation in the summer and not then having the principals meeting when they had gotten everything ready before that, I think is a sign that they really did not think it was very urgent at all.
Jack Beatty, Richard Clark presents himself as a man who was nearly beside himself with fear and terror even at what was potentially coming and could not get the attention of the powers that be. Is that a damning critique? Is that a classic, you know, plaint over bureaucratic gummed works?
Well, I think in some ways it is a classic complaint, but I think it's also, in this case, that there's an original element to it. The classic part is, you know, the military talks about the colonel's fallacy. The colonel is in the trench, and he sees an army. He sees forces coming at him. He thinks it's World War III. Really, it's a skirmish. But he's ordering this massive response, and the people on the front line, people behind him, say, "Gee whiz, we see the whole battlefield. We know this is just a skirmish line. Deal with it, and you'll be all right." Well, in a way, Mr. Clark, not in the bowels, but in the is saying terrorism, terrorism, terrorism. And both administrations, it seems to me, are saying, well, you know, yes, terrorism, but if we try to do something in Afghanistan, we're going to have to deal with Pakistan. They're allied with the Taliban. How do we deal with that? If we put boots on the ground in Afghanistan, not a country in the world will support us. If we, and then the military, and then all the other complexities. So in other words, they keep saying, sure, we'd like to do something, but if you saw the big picture as we do, you realize we can't do anything. And I think really Clark put his finger on it when he said, Americans have to have the body bags before they're going to mobilize to take an initiative that actually looks, says to Pakistan, stop tomorrow, period, because we're going into Afghanistan. That's what they did after September 11th.
And yet these hearings, Ruhl Gerecht, are about why the U.S. was not more responsive in the face of evidence, why the ifs, ands, and buts may have slowed this down, and of course, the case that Richard Clark is sometimes explicitly, sometimes implicitly making is that the Bush administration simply had other priorities and it wasn't going to be bothered with the bee in his bonnet.
Well, I mean, I'm a bit doubtful of that. I mean, I think it is fair to say that in any type of transition, energy is lost. But I say again, I mean, if in fact the Clinton administration had thought that the case was so urgent, you would have thought that with the coal attack, they would have moved and moved forcefully. I would even argue that if the Clinton administration had done so, I think it would have reinforced Vice President Gore and the following presidential campaign, and who knows, he might have won. I think that it is absolutely true that an American and a system in Washington, D.C., that the passive voice always has the upper hand, and that it requires an act of presidential will to overcome the conservatism, the caution that is endemic in the State Department, the Central Intelligence Agency, and the military brass at the Pentagon. And that certainly wasn't present for the first 7.5 months of the Bush administration. President Bush did not come in and say, let's go to war against Osama bin Laden.
You know, Ruhl Gerecht, your reputation as a pretty hard-nosed guy. Don't you feel some kind of direct sympathy with what Richard Clark must have been feeling in those months when he felt he saw the threat and he could not get the organization to act?
Sure. I mean, I actually think Richard Clark probably had a decent, if not excellent, understanding of the implications of catastrophic terrorism. And certainly if you look at the book written by his assistants, Daniel Benjamin and Stephen Simon, The Age of Sacred Terror, which I think is the best book yet written on the rise of bin Ladenism and the American response to it, and a powerful current in that book is the frustration of Richard Clark's office. But that is the frustration which is primarily aimed at the Clinton administration. And though they are loyal troopers, you don't have to read much between the lines to see that they really wanted to have a more aggressive leadership on the part of President Clinton on this issue. But Mr. Clinton simply didn't provide it.
And yet the temperature was rising as it came into that transition and that Bush administration. It seems to be, at least as it's told now, where Clark's frustration peaked. He got some tough questioning today. Let's listen here as former Illinois Governor James Thompson, Republican, questions Clark's credibility, referring to a press interview he gave in the summer, a briefing he gave in the summer of 2002, in which he praised the Bush administration's early action against terrorism.
You said the Bush administration decided then, you know, mid-January, that's mid-January 2001, to do two things. One, vigorously pursue the existing policy, that would be the Clinton policy, including all of the lethal covert action findings, which we've now made public to some extent. Is that so? Did they decide in January of 2001 to vigorously pursue the existing Clinton policy?
They decided that the existing covert action findings would remain in effect.
Okay. The second thing the administration decided to do is to initiate a process to look at those issues which had been on the table for a couple of years and get them decided. Now, that seems to indicate to me that proposals have been sitting on the table in the Clinton administration for a couple of years, but that the Bush administration was going to get them done. Is that a correct assumption?
Well, that was my hope at the time. It turned out not to be the case.
Well, then why in August of 2002, over a year later, did you say that it was the case?
I was asked to make that case to the press. I was a special assistant to the president, and I made the case I was asked to make.
Are you saying to me that you were asked to make an untrue case to the press and the public and that you went ahead and did it?
No, sir.
Not untrue.
Not an untrue case. I was asked to highlight the positive aspects of what the administration had done and to minimize the negative aspects of what the administration had done. And as a special assistant to the president, one is frequently asked to do that kind of thing. I've done it for several presidents.
Richard Clark there, torn in a way that is not hard to understand. The provenance, Jack, the background of the transcript, I guess, of this briefing or the origin is quite interesting in itself.
Well, yes, Hillary Clinton might call it the vast right-wing conspiracy strikes again, because this was he gave a background briefing to reporters, and as you know, background briefings are a senior administration said. And
No names.
But he gave it to Fox News as well as others, and of course Fox went back into its files and in a clear and balanced presentation presented that to the press today to discredit Mr. Clark's testimony.
So his shield of anonymity was stripped away.
That's right. Yeah. And of course the White House now is echoing this and saying, look what you said then, and so on. And the reason they're doing this, of course, is that this Clark testimony is the first real political backlash to President Bush's decision to go to war in Iraq. The Democrats folded. We heard something from Howard Dean, but he had no credibility. This is Mr. Credibility in terrorism saying, Mr. President, this decision has hurt the war on terror. And that's just the charge the administration does not want to hear and that they're at pains to discredit.
Lawrence Korb, as you listen to this reprising of a briefing from 2002 where Clark was formally supportive of the Bush administration, does this discredit his criticism now?
No, I don't think so, because as he pointed out, he was highlighting the good parts rather than giving a balanced view. I mean, basically, he was doing, you know, what the president did when he said that, you know, we found uranium, or that the Iraqis tried to buy uranium from Niger. He said British intelligence has learned. That was correct. He didn't tell us, but our own intelligence agencies disagree. And so Clark was doing it on a background basis, saying, here are the things that they did. And rather than saying, yes, but they didn't do them quickly, or that in fact they didn't really enhance the Clinton plan or anything like that. So I mean, I think that happens a lot to people in government when you're presenting one side of the case. They're like, you know, lawyers rather than presenting a balanced view. But I do think it made life difficult for him, you know, when he had to deal with that with Governor Thompson's questions today.
And that anonymity stripped right away. We're going to hear more tape from Clark, tape from George Tenet. Stick with us. We're talking tonight about day two of the 9/11 hearings on Capitol Hill and what they tell us about the road to 9/11. We're joined by Lawrence Korb, Rule Gorecht, and our own news analyst, Jack Beattie. You can join the conversation. Does Richard Clark's testimony leave the Bush administration with some serious explaining to do? Or not? Is Clark's condemnation credible to you? And after all the waiting, what is the takeaway from these 2 days of public testimony? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are looking at day two of the 9/11 hearings on Capitol Hill tonight and what they tell us about the road to 9/11. We're joined tonight from Washington by Lawrence Korb, senior advisor for the Center for Defense Information, and by Rule Gorecht, director of the Middle East Initiative at the Project for a New American Century. Jack Beattie is with us. You can join us as well at 1-800-423-8255. We will hear more tape in a moment from George Tenet, CIA director. But first, let's take a call or two. Dave is calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Hi, Dave. You're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to point out that it seems to me that if anything was missing from this testimony, it was John Ashcroft and Janet Reno. And if anything highlighted the difference between the two administrations before 9/11, it would have been the priority that the Justice Department put on terrorism. With Reno, I believe it was the top priority, and she had increased funding steadily for anti-terrorism efforts. And with Ashcroft, it wasn't even in the top seven. And when he was asked to appropriate an extra $58 million for anti-terrorism efforts, he declined.
You're talking about these two memos, one from April of 2000, I think, Janet Reno's memo, where she makes counterterrorism the top priority for the Department of Justice. John Ashcroft memo from May of 2001, as you say, seven strategic goals, no mention of counterterrorism, a serious departure from Reno.
It seems to me that if anyone had a shot at stopping 9/11, it would have been the FBI with the flight schools and Massawi, and also then with the information from the CIA that there were two terrorists in the U.S., Al-Qaeda.
David, it's a good point, and let us pick it up. Lawrence Korb, what do you make of this? It appears to be a real shift in emphasis on the part of the Department of Justice. We know we're only getting a glimpse of what this commission is up to, but we don't have an attorney general testifying here.
Well, that's correct. I mean, we do have the documents, and we also have the Ashcroft's strategic plan from August of 2001, which doesn't even list it, as a very high priority. And then right after September 11th, the White House cut the emergency request for counterterrorism funds by the FBI by nearly two-thirds. So I think it shows that this administration basically is trying to rewrite history. After September 11th, they said, oh, yeah, we were really focused on it. The fact of the matter is they did not treat it as the top priority and allowed the sort of the system to work, the slow, cumbersome system. And as a result, they did not, take the steps that they might have to mitigate the, what happened on September 11th.
Rule correct, is that material evidence that terrorism had, in some degree, fallen off the screen in the Bush administration, that it fell off the priority list of the Attorney General?
Oh, I don't think that much, really. I mean, I think the most insightful commentary by Janet Reno was, in fact, her insistence on treating terrorism as a form of crime. I mean, she was on the cutting edge inside of the Clinton administration and being very legalistic of how you prosecute terrorism and go after it. She was always counseling proportionality and strikes, and she was very disinclined to look at terrorism as a policy issue that needed to be handled first and foremost in a military manner. So, and again, I did not see during the Clinton years, one can make a very good argument for why you wouldn't want this to happen, but I certainly didn't see during the Clinton years an aggressive use of police powers to fight counterterrorism. Mr. Clark, for example, is quite in favor of establishing an American MI5 to prosecute to prosecute the war on terrorism and to preempt it in the United States. Now that is a serious proposal. I'm not sure I'm in favor of it, but that's
talking about kind of a domestic intelligence agency along the lines of Britain's.
That's correct. I mean that would be really upping the ante in the United States, but simply throwing cash around. I mean, I would argue both domestically and internationally, the United States probably spends too much money on intelligence, and we would have a better intelligence service if we spent less.
Still, Jack Beatty, I have to say, I look at these priority lists, and these are priorities.
They are, and of course it's partial. She was Janet Reno's deputy, but Jamie Gorelick, a commission member, in one of her questions today, said that Janet Reno picked up the FBI and shook it until information came out of the ear, out of its ears to connect one of these plots. I think it was the Millennium one, I'm not sure. And she was implicitly saying Mr. Ashcroft did not lay a glove on the FBI. And anyone who knows anything about Washington knows you have to shake it and shake it mighty hard to get anything out of it. And then, the other thing, I mean, the people that perpetrated the bombing of 1993 of the World Trade Center are in prison.
True enough. Let's listen to some tape from that very questioning where Jamie Gorelick asked CIA Director George Tenet how seriously the Bush administration took terrorism threats in the months before 9/11.
I was struck by the comment that the president made in Bush at War that bin Laden was not the focus of his national security team. He said, I didn't feel that sense of urgency. My blood was not nearly as boiling. And I think that's a fairly candid comment on his part. Did he evidence that he was seized with the urgent nature?
Look, by the spring and summer, everybody was seized with the urgency of this nature by virtue of what I was telling them. And by this time period, the CSG is meeting every day. We're taking actions to undertake disruptions. The Defense Department is taking security precautions at its facilities. The State Department is taking security precautions at facilities overseas. The CSG is issuing advisories to the FAA. So this period of time saw an enormous amount of activity, typical to the kind of activity we saw in previous threat periods. And all I can tell you is the policymakers got it, because I talked to all of them about it, and they understood the nature of what we're dealing with.
Let me follow up on that, because you have said, and this is a quote from you, I went into millennium threat mode.
Right.
Your phrase, meaning what was done at the end of 1999. But in the millennium threat mode, all of the principals were summoned to the NSC table to ensure that their departments could do everything they could. Now, while in the administration in 2001 there were policy meetings, there were not deputies committee meetings and or principals committee meetings around the threat. And to be sure, the CSG was meeting, but as we will hear later today, the CSG operates at a different level. Now, as it turns out, you didn't know what was inside the FBI. For goodness sakes, the FBI didn't know what was inside the FBI. 18 of the 19 hijackers entered this country after April 2001. In the millennium, Attorney General Reno, we have been told, literally turned the FBI upside down and shook it and got information out of it that it might not have been able, it might not have in some way disgorged. I mean, the NSC didn't know that al-Midhar and al-Hamzi were the subject of an FBI search, or that the FBI had found Arab men trying to take flying lessons but not to learn how to take off or land, or that the FAA didn't have the benefit of the State Department watch list.
My sense of it is at the time was I was talking to the National Security Advisor and the President and the Vice President every day. I know that she was talking to her colleagues and principals. I know she had a meeting of domestic agencies sometime in July. I know the CSG was meeting. You know, maybe the method of communication was different. I did not see any less attention to what we were trying to do.
George Tenet saying everyone was doing their best talking about the CSG, the Counterterrorism and Security Group. Lawrence Korb, as you listen over these couple of days, and obviously there's been much more testimony that we're not hearing, what's your takeaway here? I'm hearing these last couple of days, well, geez, it was tough. There were lots of constraints and problems. We did all we could. And yet isn't the point of this commission inquiry to give Americans more than that, to be more specific in assigning accountability so the country might be better prepared in the future?
Well, I think so, and you're right. I mean, I thought it was interesting that given the way that they beat up on them in the campaign, you know, saying the Clintons were weak and they had all these terrible policies, that basically they're saying, oh, we had the same policy as Clinton did. And I think Americans should know why both administrations didn't take the actions that they did. And if there were, as somebody pointed out, legal constraints, we need to take a look at that. I think one of the things that's got to be done is the Director of Central Intelligence needs to be empowered. He needs to have personnel authority. He needs to have budget authority. He needs to have tasking authority. And you ought to have a separate director for the CIA so that somebody could bring all of this stuff together and at least have the wherewithal to make sure that something like this doesn't happen again.
Let me get a couple of calls. Mary's calling from East Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Mary. You're on the air.
Hi there. I wanted to say that I was very struck by Clark's initial statement apologizing and taking responsibility for the terrible events that happened. And this points out by omission, glaring omission, the absolute lack of responsibility of the Bush administration. In fact, their aversion to taking responsibility, not only have they not done so, they have tried their best to obstruct this entire inquiry, have not given it enough time, have not given them access to documents, and they are simply avoiding the primary responsibility of a leader, which is, in fact, when something happens that goes wrong, you find out who's to blame, and If you can't, you say, I am the top person. I am to blame.
Mary, do you pin that specifically on the Bush administration, or would you like to see officials standing up right back into the Clinton administration as well, apologizing?
I'd be happy to have all of them do it, but I do find it much more galling that Bush and all their people do not do it because they don't do it about anything. They're always avoiding responsibility. You don't see Bush talking about the wounded from Iraq. You don't see them talking about, you know, any of those things. And so when you're talking, when there's such a huge national tragedy, there needs to be that. And I think that what Clark said might have a great impact on the families. I wasn't personally involved, but it certainly had an impact on me.
But for someone not just to say they're sorry, but that they apologize.
Yes, take responsibility. It's an adult thing to do. I think this administration is infantile.
Mary, thank you for your call. Jack, it was a singular moment when Richard Clark chose to do that in his opening statement. It's something we didn't hear from anybody else here.
No, and think what a slap that is to all the other people who went up there and said hello and gravely went on about their business, not a word like this. I think this is a moment, and I'm not drawing any other parallels to it, but it reminded me of the moment in the McCarthy hearings when Joe Welch looked at Senator McCarthy and said, Senator, I have not till this moment judged the depth of your maliciousness. And actually, there was a real moment. A real person spoke. And we heard that, I think, today in that comment.
Ruhlgerecht, where do you think we're going to end up after this whole process in terms of accountability? Americans want it. I guess they deserve it from their government. Are they going to get it out of this commission?
Oh, I'd say probably not. I mean, I think that the commission isn't going to be particularly revelatory, except perhaps in the domain of what American intelligence did or did not do. I think otherwise it's going to put together, perhaps more cogently, and certainly with a better theater, what we knew before. And, I mean, some of the people who testified today, I think, you know, and certainly those who testified yesterday, more or less summed it up, and that was that both the Clinton administration and the Bush administration, up until September 9th of 2001, you know, operated conventionally. That is, they treated terrorism more or less, they had a pretty high tolerance for terrorism, and even though that some of the individuals in the Clinton administration and the Bush administration realized the possible impact of increasing catastrophic terrorism, more or less they couldn't break themselves out of the conventional way of looking at it, and they couldn't do what Mr. Clark actually had recommended, and that is preemptive war. Which, by the way, I think the Bush administration learned the lesson of, and they used it in Iraq.
He wanted them to go to Afghanistan. They did, but it was after 9/11. Lawrence Cole, we just got half a minute, but finally to you. Clinton is not standing for re-election. George Bush is. How do you think he'll be judged by the public off of the testimony that they're hearing in these days and days to come? Is his war presidency, particularly in the run-up to 9/11, going to help or hurt?
No, I think it's going to hurt him because he basically has been campaigning on, you know, the fact that he was a steady leader and he's done all the right things. And now we know that there were a lot of things that he didn't do that he should have. And as Raul just said, treated it, you know, sort of as business as usual. No, I think this hurts him because, as you say, you can't hurt Clinton. He's not running anymore.
But George Bush is, and there will be a full report coming out just as the Democrats sit down for their convention. Lawrence Korb, thank you very much for joining us tonight. Good to have you.
My pleasure.
Lawrence Korb, Senior Advisor for the Center for Defense Information, and Ruhlgerecht in Washington. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Ruhlgerecht, Resident Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Jack Beatty, last word to you.
This is Mr. Clark. I said we'll never know if it could have been prevented, and I've said that over and again. We'll never know.
Well, there it is. The report will come out. Jack, good to have you here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.